Anti-trans bills are happening at literally every level of government in the United States, disguised with terms like parental bills of rights and family freedom. These bills and these laws are basically gaslighting us into a state where we're just attacking some of our most vulnerable young people. When thinking about the impact that these pieces of legislation are having, there was one person in particular that I knew I could turn to, and that's Dr. Ken Schneck. Ken is the program director for the Leadership in Higher Education program at Baldwin-Wallace University in Ohio. And Ken and I crossed paths years ago through NASPA. He's been a leader in the student affairs space for decades and a huge proponent of the advantages of small colleges on the development of our college students. So big fan of Ken and his advocacy work for small colleges. I'm also a big fan of Ken because he's a journalist too and a political junkie. And he's a writer and editor at the Buckeye Flame, Ohio's award-winning LGBTQ news outlet. Ken has written, analyzed, and obsessed over the impact of these anti-trans bills on the youth of Ohio, and he's been thinking a lot about how this will all have an impact on higher education across the country. We go in a lot of places in the show, and I do hope you enjoy. Now, more from Ken.
So Ken, the first time I met you was at a NASPA Region 1 meeting, and you were talking about sustainable fish. Do you remember this?
100% no.
And we were talking about something to do with, okay, go ahead.
I do. You're talking about like menu fish, not like everyone buying a betta fish. I vaguely remember, did I make a stink about it? Oh gosh, I hope
yes,
I didn't.
You did.
Yes. Great.
Made a huge stink about it. And I remember this because there are not a lot of times where my husband and I were on the regional board at this same time. And I'm laughing, so I'm making myself cough. And I said to Sean on my way home from the meeting, I'm like, I'm either going to love this guy or I'm going to want to punch him in the neck.
The two are not mutually exclusive, I have found, with the professionals with whom I've worked. So that's hilarious. And what's also hilarious is that I've been a vegetarian since 2001. So that was apparently just a principled stance that I was taking, not one that I was going to consume myself. So that's hilarious.
And we still in the DeVoe home, like, what do you want for dinner tonight? Well, I think I'm going to have fish. And Sean, is it? I don't know. I'm going to have to toss it up to Ken and let me know if I'm doing it right.
Really created meaningful change in our field. So yes, thank you.
Ken Schneck is, you actually have two aspects of your life that I adore about you. One is your commitment to educating the future of the field of higher education, which I think is fantastic. And you've been committed to that. You've also seen the benefit of the small college environment and how important that is. And you're a proponent of small colleges. But you also have this connection to local journalism. Okay. So you're right now at Baldwin-Wallace University on the faculty there in their higher education program. But you're also with the Buckeye Flame. Tell us what the Buckeye Flame is.
Sure. The Buckeye Flame stands as Ohio's only statewide LGBTQ publication. There's actually only one other publication, LGBTQ plus publication in the state, and that's a student publication called Fusion at Kent State University. And I always love shouting them out at any opportunity because it's a wonderful publication. That's more once a year kind of curated offerings. Ours is a daily covering the entire state of Ohio online publication. Here in a state where LGBTQ plus people do not have legal protections in the areas of housing, public accommodations, or employment. So it's pretty critical work. The great part is that there's just a lot of overlap between my higher ed life and my journalism life.
Yeah. So before we go on to our topic today, which is about trans rights and trans bills that are and how they have an intersection with what's happening in higher ed, what got you to the point that you felt like you needed to dedicate a portion of your life and your existence to the Buckeye Flame?
When I was a dean of students at Marlborough College in Southern Vermont, the now defunct closed Marlborough College, someone from Huffington Post had reached out and said, we're starting a new section called College Voices. And do you have anybody pretty offbeat who could write for us? Do we ever? We've got this guy who's going to write about sustainable fish. And so that's how I started writing for the Huffington Post. And what I quickly realized was that gave me access to writing for all of these other sections in the Huffington Post, because the College Voices section didn't have a ton of readership at the time. So I got to write for their, it started as Gay Voices section and then became their Queer Voices section, and wrote for their Impact section as well. So I've been working in this journalism space for a few decades now, but I don't want to also discount that College Voices section. I remember, and I'm sure you will recall this, when there was a very prominent suicide of a higher ed professional at the University of Vermont. This was about a decade ago. Sure. And it made me flashback to my own higher ed program at NYU, when also there was an extraordinarily prominent suicide at 9 a.m. It was very public, of someone who oversaw counseling services. And it made me remember that we that night did not have a conversation in class about that. Mm. And so I had this flashback that I truly had blocked out. And so I wrote a piece for the Huffington Post College Voices section. I think the headline was something like Student Affairs Administrators Get Suicidal Too. And it opened up a conversation, apparently, about mental health of people who work in our field, and the way that we can be competitive sometimes and having the most traumatic story and vicarious trauma, and how the more that we respond to traumatic events, it can actually affect us. And this idea that sometimes we pass ourselves off as counselors and we're 100% not counselors. And not only is that potentially damaging for students, but it's not great for our wellness either. So that piece and the reception that it got really showed to me in a very concrete way the ways that journalism can start important conversations. So it's been a commitment of mine for a while. When Ohio then suddenly in 2020 didn't have an LGBTQ publication, I just stepped into that mix and said, we've got to start one. So that's where we are.
I appreciate you doing that. And I think one of the things you were just talking about has an absolute connection to, we just dropped on the day we're recording this, the day prior, we dropped an episode regarding Black women and how Black women in academia are facing an unprecedented amount of scrutiny, as well as bullying in the workplace and that sort of thing. And the mental health issues that go into that, and became very clear with the suicide of Antoinette Candida Bailey over at Lawrence University at the HBCU recently. She's the vice president for student affairs there, who took her own life. And so I appreciate you pulling all of this together. It's mucky and it's messy, but the need of voicing what's actually happening is why journalism matters, and why people having access to seeing something in print, whether it be a piece of paper or online, that is well positioned to say, hey, this is real, and maybe something you're experiencing is something that you, it's not just you. There are other people feeling this, and we have to be aware of it, and there has to be a call to action. So I appreciate that.
Well, and I have all the privilege in the world, right? For me to not be saying things that others might be nervous to say because they're a little dangerous for our jobs. I'm a white, tenured, full professor of education. I'm good. I have the safety. For me to not dive into the messiness would be irresponsible.
Absolutely. I reached out to you because I was looking at what was happening in Ohio, and there was a brief moment where there was almost this moment of hopium happening in my world, but I don't live in Ohio. But I saw that there was going to be a point where maybe things were going to move just because of a gubernatorial veto. And then it went off the rails. And I reached out to you because I said, I think we need to unpack what's happening in Ohio around trans rights. But we also have to understand how this is impacting higher ed. And you have said, absolutely, this has an absolute connection to higher ed. We need to be paying attention to it. So for our listeners who are not fully up to it, what can you give us kind of the Cliff Notes version of what the status of legislation, anti-trans legislation is in Ohio and how it's impacting things on the ground?
Yeah. Let me just say from the 42,000 foot view, by the way, I don't know what height planes fly at, and my boyfriend's a flight attendant, so I really should learn that for whatever I say from here on out. This is one of the reasons why it's so critically important that all of our preparatory programs have a public policy class. It is so built into our practice. I can honestly say this, before I became a faculty member as a dean of students, it wasn't part of my routine, my daily practice to read Inside Higher Ed every morning, to read higher ed. Like, I just wasn't reading those every morning. And it really has made me a better professional. As I tell the students, my students, do I read every single article every day? Not even remotely. And there's some days I don't even scan the bullets. But for the most part during the week, I do. And it makes me a better professional. And I built that into our assignments for students. We're talking about FERPA tonight in class, and they had to find an article from the past couple months on FERPA, and they didn't have to go back more than 48 hours because stuff just happened. So it's really important that we have those classes. That's just my little public service announcement for our programs.
I agree.
Yeah, it's pretty messy here in Ohio. I am a politics junkie, so I tend to follow these bills really closely. There's a couple in particular that affect higher ed quite deeply. The big ones right now, HB 183 is a bathroom bill, and that one's moving pretty quickly. And HB 183, House Bill 183, is a bill that would require all individuals in any multi-person restroom. So we're not talking about individual use restrooms. In all multi-person restrooms, they will have to use the restroom that corresponds to the birth certificate that was issued at or near the time of their birth, because the Republicans here in Ohio realized that you change your birth certificate. So they're talking about original birth certificates. And when I talk about bills like this, people think, oh yeah, that would be terrible in K through 12. Absolutely not. This bill 100% affects higher ed. It would require this of trans professors. Professors who are using a multi-person restroom here in Ohio would have to use the restroom that corresponds to their birth certificate. It also, in a line in this bill, says that no colleges or universities can maintain all gender multi-person restrooms. So for example, Cleveland State University, right outside my door here, I get the impression they spent a good $15,000-$16,000 building their multi-person all gender restroom. This bill requires that they decommission that restroom. They're not allowed to build new ones, and they cannot maintain current ones. How this is enforced, nobody knows, but it creates a certain climate. So HB 183 is one that clearly affects higher ed. HB 68 is the one that you mentioned that is quite national, and it certainly affects higher ed and has two different pieces to it. On one piece of this bill, it bans gender-affirming care for all minors in Ohio so that no youth in Ohio will be able to access mental health or physical gender-affirming care. Another part of that bill is it bans trans female athletes in K through 12, sure, also in college. So any college, public or private, that allows for trans female athletes will have to ban them from female sports teams. So that one absolutely affects higher ed.
Not trans males.
No, they don't care about trans males. In almost none of these bills do they care about trans males. And then the one that I'm particularly obsessed with, I mean, let me just say with HB 68, yes, it passed the House and the Senate, and then it went to the governor, and the governor vetoed it. And then they overrode the veto, both the House and the Senate. So that goes into law in late April. What that means is that a number of families are going to move out of Ohio because it also effectively criminalizes healthcare providers in the state of Ohio from recommending gender-affirming care in another state. They're not even allowed to recommend it. It's called aiding and abetting. So any number of families are going to pick up and leave or not even move here, which then affects the population that our colleges are able to draw from, because it's going to be some families that are not going to move here.
Right.
There are tons more, but one more that I want to throw out at you is HB 8, which is the Parents' Bill of Rights. By the way, I should say HB 183, the bathroom bill, they actually renamed it. And you got to highlight this irony. It is no longer called the bathroom bill. It's called the Protect All Students Act.
Yeah. It's all the same kind of theme of dog whistle of this, we're protecting this thing. I mean, it happens with everything from, I was just reading a local news story here about zoning of all things and the way people are positioning zoning about protection and saving. And like, are you protecting or are you trying to keep people out? What are we doing here? So
yeah.
It's the same theme. It's this empowerment, alleged empowerment, but it's not. It's about control and it's about hurting the other,
demonizing LGBTQ people, which we know does play for some of these Republican representatives in their red districts, in their rural districts. How forcing a trans professor who had gender affirmation surgery 10 years ago, who's been trans her whole life and has been living as a trans woman publicly for decades, forcing her to go into a men's restroom is protecting all students, right? It's all about that dog whistle.
Right.
Another one, the one that I'm obsessed with is HB 8, which is called the Parents' Bill of Rights. And the Parents' Bill of Rights would force all teachers and school staff in K through 12. And school staff includes counselors, school psychologists, and school social workers who automatically out LGBTQ youth to their parents, even if there is suspected abuse in the home. That parents have the right to know this information, and this is forced outing. How does this affect higher ed? Well, it does in a couple different ways. First of all, just even on our education level, I make any number of appearances being a professor of education. They occasionally pull me into K through 12 classes, although I largely don't know what they're talking about because they talk in acronyms. But occasionally they'll have me in to talk about diversity in K through 12 and how do we add a children's book, add one out of every 10 children's books. That would be awesome if it had same-sex parents. Or if you're teaching about Martin Luther King Jr., please also teach about Bayard Rustin, right? Just different ways that you can incorporate in LGBTQ issues in a way that normalizes it for students so that LGBTQ students in K through 12 don't feel like such outliers. So I have no idea what I'm supposed to say to these teachers, because it's irresponsible not to tell them that the law will be, this one is not law yet, but that the law likely will be by the end of 2024 that they have to out LGBTQ youth to their parents. It's not an option for these teachers to say, well, I won't do it. I mean, you can, but you are putting your licensure in jeopardy.
Right.
So there's that. The other piece too, right? I'm a huge fan of systems thinking, and I try to train my students so much on, you can make any decision you want. You just have to predict the next three things that are going to happen.
Yeah.
So this is going to result in not just LGBTQ students, but any number of students not confiding in trusted sources in K through 12 education, which means once they get to college, they are going to explode. The experimentation part, so many different things that they've never been able to really either talk about or explore, that's going to be that orientation is going to be a very heady orientation for many of these students. And as we know, let's just stick with the LGBTQ piece for a second. As we know, nobody really knows the stats, but as much as college-age students are interacting with alcohol and other drugs, we know that LGBTQ plus students are interacting with alcohol and other drugs even more, not because we're predispositioned to it, but because of all the different pressures and all the different things that they're experiencing. For these students, there's just that much more danger involved in the harm here if they, for the first time, are really able to explore their LGBTQ plus identity in college. So that could have quite the impact.
And
that
also
a lot.
It's a lot. And I'm glad you're talking, because a lot of times one of my big issues from a continuity of young people's experiences is that we talk about K-12 in a way, like you just said, it's all acronyms, it's metrics that go click, 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 click. What are we doing? Blah, 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 blah. I don't know enough about it. Like, I am not somebody who's going to go out there and they say, what do you want to do? I'm like, I don't know. I know what my 17-year-old has experienced over the course of her life, but I'm not an expert. But I think one of the things we do poorly is we don't necessarily connect the K-12 experience from a growth mindset, not even the classroom work, okay, and that sort of thing. I mean, that is an issue on its own, but that growth mindset of what happens in the K-12 up until higher ed, there's a continuum there. It's not like they just like, okay, starting it off, now turn it on, and now we're in a different environment. If you haven't had an experience that has been nurturing and caring and open to, okay, here it is, whether it be your sexuality or learning disability or whatever it might be in the K-12 environment, and learning how to navigate this world and then go up to higher ed, and you've never experienced it, you've never acknowledged it, you've never had support mechanisms, that's a recipe for disaster. And we just don't manage that well. We see it with men and masculinity come through time and time again, is that K-12 doesn't address some of the things that become problematic in a higher ed environment. So instead of embracing men and that, what is masculinity? What does that actually look like in practice? How do we reinforce positive aspects of masculinity? It's no, no, no. It's like beating it down. Like, no, that's not helpful. The kid needs an outlet to and good role models to show what that actually looks like. That being said, going back to the aspect of the LGBTQ+ communities, if they're completely shut out, we can even look at a microcosm of what just happened during COVID, when our young people did not have that opportunity to make mistakes in high school that were typical of the 15 to 18 year old, 14 to 18 year old environment. Like, did you go to a house party? No, we couldn't go anywhere. We were all shut up. Did you go to this? No, we didn't have a prom. Did we do this? No, I mean, we didn't do it. We didn't have interactions. And now we're seeing it on our own campuses when they show up and they literally explode. They're like, or they don't know how to interact.
Right.
They don't
know how to interact. And so what would it look like if we're instituting a policy where we're basically conditioning high school students to not talk to a trusted source who has resources? Yeah. We are sending the message. I mean, we're sending the message that information is going to be shared with your families. And so it's so hilarious that we focus so much on, so I call it the magical summer, the summer in between senior year of high school and for your first year of college, when suddenly we expect that these students have magically learned how to advocate for themselves. Suddenly they just spent their entire K-12 experience with an IEP that their parents were intimately involved in, and then magical summer, and suddenly you need to advocate for your own disability without your parents, right? It's hilarious that we expect that when we know that high schools and middle schools don't talk to each other. So this whole idea of systems thinking, what would it mean? I would love to see that more on our college campuses, of the professors talking to other professors and saying, oh, and right, so this is endemic to a small school, and this is part of my bias, and I know that. But if you're working in a small school, why not go to Laura and say, hey, Laura, I have Betty this semester. Were there any methods that particularly you thought resonated with her? I would love to know that, instead of everybody just going with their own inflexible methodology that we know doesn't work for everybody. Because if you're telling me, I really did see her light up when we used a movie to inspire this conversation on Chickering. Awesome. I can adjust my syllabus enough to throw in a movie.
Right.
But we don't have those conversations.
We don't have conversations on the global, on a larger scale, other than that idea of deficit thinking, in that deficit mindset of, oh, well, what do we have to do to overcome that? It's like, no, there's other ways we can actually provide the support. And you and I come from small college environments where we know like what works well. And there is a reason that still 40% of the institutions in America have an enrollment of under 2,000, right? So like it is working for somebody. The problem is it's not working for the CFOs. Different show. Okay.
Different show.
The one of the things that this last couple minutes is making me a little nervous. Okay. It's making me panic. I have a paper bag underneath the table. So if you see me pull it out and start breathing into it, there's what we got. But we've got so many states right now that are dealing with their own flavors of HB 183, HB 68, HB 8. They've got their own ones. Okay. And that kind of that scaling it up. If you have students in various states where they are now their parents, their lifestyle, their life environment is criminalized. Where are they going? What are they doing? How are they feeling from a mindset? We've got not just Ohio, we've got right. many states out there. As you've been reporting on this, my question goes to the composition of these bills. Where are they coming from? Are they hooked up right there in Ohio, or are they similar to things like we see with these book ban legislations and stuff around reproductive health, where this is the blueprint? You go to the Turning Point USA conference, or you go here, or you get on this Google Drive, and they're just handing it out. Okay. So what are your thoughts on that?
It's exactly what you just said. So we do a lot of comparative bill analyses, and yep, these are word for word bills that are being introduced across the country. Many of them are coming from the religious right. And by many, I mean all. There was just a recorded conversation on Twitter about a week and a half ago where the Republican representative here in Ohio, who's behind HB 68, Gary Click, Pastor Gary Click, who's my arch nemesis, who went to an unaccredited college, Midwestern Bible College, I think it's called, where their handbook is a hoot. And I got my hands on their handbook, and it's men and women shall not go shopping together. There will be no country music. Students must stand when the professor enters the room. That one I agree with. But he had a meeting with Michigan representatives, and they talked about how these are our shared goals. This isn't just about youth. They are making moves to restrict gender-affirming care for adults as well. So that's going to affect our students greatly. But yes, there is a lot of coordination here. The Family Research Council has a huge hand in all of this. You have these paid actors. I don't mean stage actors, right? But these paid individuals who just go from state to state and testify. Right. Here in Ohio for HB 68, I think the ratio was something like 25-1 of people who testified opposing HB 68. And when you look at the one, right, and it wasn't just one person, that was just the one in the ratio.
Right.
Most of those were people who were shipped in from other states whose lodging was paid for. I mean, it's not that scenic in Columbus, Ohio, but, you know, we weren't paying for it here. So right. Yes, there's a lot of coordination, and we're just going to see this ramp up in an election year. We see here in Ohio that the biggest uptick in activity is right before the legislature goes on break, right before they go back to their districts and need to campaign and say, look how I, and the phrase is always protected children. Yeah. Look how I protected these children from these rogue doctors. Look how I protected these children from their abusive parents. Right. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the ironies between HB 8 and HB 68. Great. Parents' Bill of Rights. Well, what about the parents of trans children to decide the health care of their children? And the Republicans here in Ohio are saying the quiet part out loud. They're saying those parents are child abusers who right. allow their children to interact with any type of gender affirming care. And they skip right to surgeries on minors, which are 100% not right. happening in Ohio. Yeah. So they go right back to their districts and they say, look how I'm protecting children. Vote for me. I mean, the week before every single session, they're about to head back to their district. So it's very political. It has nothing to do with protecting children. Yeah, we're about to break some news in the next week. And I don't want to say quite yet, But it will clearly display the irony. There's another bill about banning drag in public, which will affect colleges as well. And there's some irony with one of the relatives of one of the sponsors. I'll just leave it there.
And there always is. There's always, always irony. There's always, you and I both have an appreciation of politics. And we also always say, and when is the shoe going to fall where we find out someone in the family is XYZ? Or when are we going to find out that the person actually promoting the bill has something in the, we peel back the onion and we find something and we go, here we go.
Exactly.
And so, you know, there is that element. I think that there's that flavor of these bills. I think that that playbook of, if it was back in a certain era, it would all be pulled up a Mimeo machine and everything was on that same blue paper that everybody would have gotten. But nowadays, it's just easier because they can literally just hand out these playbooks state to state to state and give people, here are your messaging points. Here are the things that we know work. Here's what, because they're literally workshopping this in real time. They know what's hitting, they know what's not hitting, and they know how to manage it. And these people who are shopping these bills around know exactly what they're doing. The thing that I also worry about that you've brought up about how is this going to impact our campuses? I think about my people in a health and counseling center, in a wellness space on a campus. And that idea of there's so much going on some of, in some of these states right now. There's so much happening where that same health and counseling center just a little over a year ago was dealing with, okay, we can't have Plan B anymore. We can't allow any kind of reproductive health care for women who might need it in terms of that. We can't allow this. We can't allow that. That's now taken away. That's now stripped. And now you've got counselors and people who are here to help students who might be dealing with whatever trauma, whatever issues they might be having in their own environment, and they can't even have free conversations with them. And how is that impacting their ability to do their jobs? Do you see at all any concerns from the health center, wellness center space in your state? Where are you hearing or are you seeing lots of vacancies, lots of unresolved issues? We know that there are not enough counselors, mental health counselors on any campus. But if you don't feel like your work is valued there, have you seen anything in particular that is unnerving to you?
I'm going to go the other route. I am liking that I'm seeing more advocacy on behalf of mental health organizations. So the Social Workers Association of Ohio, the Mental Health Counselors Association of Ohio, that no longer can we say that this work isn't political. I don't know how we ever could have said it wasn't political. It always has been. But you are literally violating our code of ethics in these bills about confidentiality, about doing no harm, about suspected abuse and what we report. We are, Baldwin Wallace is about to launch, we just got the accreditation, I think last week, a school counselor program. And so how that's going to affect recruitment and what we're going to tell them in preparing them. Because again, you can't prepare them by saying, and just tell any student you will keep anything confidential. Because if that's not what the legislature says, it's irresponsible for us to tell them that. That said, I like this piece that I'm seeing that where we're bridging the gap and these organizations are stepping forward and saying what you're doing is not just harming youth, but it's harming our professionals. And right. So we're going to teach our students how to do advocacy days. I love bringing college students to a lobbying day. These should not, right? We have to dispel. We know that we still have those ivory towers. We still have these schools where that wall between town and gown is unscalable. And that is irresponsible at this point. And I will say in particular for private colleges. And kind of the same way I feel about Cleveland. Cleveland has all of these protections. All of the protections that Ohio doesn't have, Cleveland does offer. The end of that story shouldn't be, then everything's great in Cleveland. The end of that story is the same as it should be for private colleges. Then Cleveland and private colleges have the responsibility, because they have the more protections, to go out there and role model what it looks like to advocate. Mm-hmm. We're not in danger. I mean, some of these bills will affect private schools as well. But for example, and I'm sure you've talked about it in other shows, talking about DEI legislation, the DEI legislation here in Ohio, that does everything from banning diversity statements and searches to banning colleges from making statements on controversial issues. And controversial issues here in Ohio is defined in the legislation as issues related to controversy. Very helpful. That one doesn't affect private colleges. Yeah. Great. That doesn't mean that colleges, private colleges should then be silent. I would argue that means they then have the responsibility to stand up because we have the protections. It goes back to what I said earlier about me having the privilege. I am a white male tenured full professor of education. That doesn't mean I get to sit on my laurels. That means the exact opposite. It means that I have the responsibility because I have that privilege. So that's what I'm seeing a lot of these counseling programs. I'm curious to see about the vacancies piece and how that will scale up. Seeing definitely more and more colleges forge partnerships with local hospitals. And I'm actually okay with that. I think that sharing of resources is a good thing, particularly given the CFO challenges that you mentioned many schools are having. More creative partnerships and more advocacy. I like seeing those things.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up. I want to drill into something you just brought up about the DEI reality. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering your thoughts on this as far as DEI and the phrase diversity, equity, and inclusion and all of the things that are pushing back against that right now, because it's in the same spirit as all these other aspects. I would like your thoughts on this kind of push-pull that people might think is in existence, is that when you have different communities that are being attacked, but all under a big umbrella, I think that there is a mindset that can all these communities get together and kind of fight back, or are they so much in their environment of we've got to protect ourselves, we've got to figure this out? What are you seeing, and what is your opinion on that?
Yeah, I think we do that, separate out communities consistently, and that's extraordinarily problematic given that it allows absolutely no opportunity for intersectional work. To say that over here we're talking about racial issues and over here we're talking about LGBTQ plus issues and here we're talking about gender, cool. Where do Black trans women go then if they have to pick one of those three, especially when we know that they are experiencing transphobia, sexism, and racism?
Right.
So yeah, it's a mandate. It has to be a mandate that we have these conversations intersectionally, that we show up for each other. I drill this conversation down to when students say to me, oh, no one's coming to our events. Mm-hmm. Okay, two things. First of all, that's not the measure of the success of your event, and stop using that as your only criteria. Let's put that over here. And please, hall directors, stop asking RAs that the first question on their evaluation form is how many people showed up. That is not the measure. So let's put that over here. Second of all, yes, people didn't show up for an event. How often are you going to everybody else's events?
Mm-hmm.
I tell the story of my really quick story on this was, I think it was 2014, and a Cleveland City Council meeting, there were two items on this agenda. And the first item was to add trans protections for Clevelanders, which weren't granted at the time. And the second item was to increase the minimum wage. And there were largely LGBTQ activists there to add trans protections and largely Black activists there to raise the minimum wage. And they started the meeting and the first item was the trans protections and they passed it and everybody applauded. And then what happened, Laura?
Then they all left.
All the LGBTQ people left.
Yeah.
And so what would it have looked like if they had stayed, right? And vice versa.
Yeah.
Right. So how are we showing up for each other? I have to tell you, if I can make this rule, and I've been told that I cannot make all the rules in student affairs because I couldn't even change the fish. If I could make one rule, right, if we could only make one rule, I would say that absolutely no student organization can access their funds. The only way that student organizations can access any money is if they co-sponsor an event with another organization. Mm-hmm. That absolutely no student organizations can host an event solo ever. Every event has to be hosted with another organization. when I used to be at Sarah Lawrence College, I loved that the Hillel would do Black Shabbat and Asian Shabbat. And it was just constantly co-sponsoring, and it brings different people and creates a different conversation. I love that. Or maybe you can only access 50% of your funds, and the only way you can access the other 50% is through co-sponsorship. And that's the same thing as I'm saying here. How are we showing up for each other? How are you going to other people's events, but not taking up space?
Hey, thank you for saying that.
Right? Not taking up space. The story that I always tell with this one is that I remember just a few years ago when they had those horrible, horrible murders of AAPI women in Atlanta. And here in Cleveland, there was a Stop Asian Hate rally. And there was a guy walking around that rally with a clipboard signing people up for environmental justice. Screw you, dude. Like, it's great that you showed up.
I'm in place.
Exactly. Let's show up for each other. And maybe we can write some rules that force students to show up for each other. I'm okay with that. But let's also not take up space and just be there for other communities. And so that's my... Yeah, I think that there are ways to manipulate and engineer intersectionality, and I'm 100% okay with that.
Yeah. I want to close out bringing it back to specifically around the trans support that might be impacted. And you alluded to this earlier when we were talking about that kind of aspect of students, their growth, moving from K-12 into higher ed. And I want to kind of pull into a little bit more and get a little more geeky around student identity theory and student identity aspects of a student's growth in their development. And when you see the shift that has been well placed over the last, say, decade in terms of supporting trans students on campus, and it is about that idea of like identity is absolutely a piece of it. Where in this kind of fight against the legislation or this acknowledgement of the legislation and what kinds of systems do we need to put in place to continue to support these students? Because the students are going to show up, hopefully, and we need to support them. As you're kind of picking this through in a like maybe more of a call to action mindset, make believe you're back in the Dean of Students like world, to say if we're going to be supportive of student identity and specifically our trans students, how do we make sure that despite what's happening around us, the student is put first and the services are provided properly?
I think it's just picking one area on your campus and making sure that it's as trans friendly as possible. And then every year picking a different area, right? Let's talk about fraternity and sorority life. The absolute worst time to have a conversation about whether someone is allowed, an individual is allowed to wear white pants to be white dress formal, whatever the event is that many sororities have. The worst time to have that conversation is when someone requests it. So let's have that in advance. Let's look at how recruitment works for, right, these often typically gendered areas of our campus, just starting with fraternity and sorority life. That is not the only area. Let's look at the movies that RAs are showing. We know the easiest way to fill some requirement is, let me just put on a movie night real quick, which is great. I love movie nights. I think every orientation should have a movie night of some sort because it gets students out, but they might not be ready to interact with other students. So that's a great thing. I'm not dissing on movie nights. It's a wonderful thing. But let's look at the representation in our movie nights, right? Let's look at the representation in our flyers around Valentine's Day for all of our different formals that we're putting out there. Are they as inclusive as possible, or are they just extraordinarily gendered?
Yeah.
Are there any single-use restrooms on campus that are gendered? If so, why? Why are there any single-use restrooms on a college campus that are labeled male or female? There is absolutely no reason for it. And one of the things that Baldwin Wallace does, and I know many schools do, is that as they have all gender restrooms, single use ones, right? Because if the other, if HB 183 goes through, we won't be able to have that. And just to dispel for people, a multi-use all gender restrooms just means floor to ceiling stalls and communal sink. That's all it means. It's basically like, well, I would never do that. Yes, you would. You've used porta-johns before that are next to another porta-john. It's exactly the same thing. So everybody needs to chill out on that who has resistance. So BW has, Bob Wallace has a map that's available on the admissions website for both current students and prospective students. Here are where the all-gender restrooms are. But when we look at Bob Wallace's campus, there are no single-use restrooms in our fitness center. So anybody who wants to use the pool and get changed automatically has to go into a multi-use, multi-person gendered space. That's an issue. So we have to look at that. I think you pick one thing a year. I think that the single-use restrooms is the easiest one.
Yep.
Go around your campus. And when I got to BW, there were two single-use restrooms in the basement. One was male, one was female in my school of education. And let me just say the female one was astronomically nicer. And so I just want to put that out there right now. And so I said, there's no reason for these to be gendered. But then I realized I had to do some education. Mm-hmm. The more experienced faculty did not understand what I was asking for. And so that's the easiest one. Walk around your campus. If there is a single use restroom on there that's gendered, there is no reason for it to be. But then every year, pick one other aspect. And we have plentiful in higher ed of gendering spaces and events that don't need to be.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And the other, I want to give a shout out to some of the very creative people in our registrar areas who say, chosen name, I don't need you to jump through a fiery hoop. Tell me what you want. Tell it to me. And we are going to make sure that your name is reflective on your academic transcript, the way you want your academic accomplishments to be, and that you don't have to walk down the Nile and get a diploma with a dead name on it. And those are those kinds of things that you have to, I agree with you 100%, one by one, and lean into your expertise. Who on your campus is an expert in that area? And you say, here's our challenge. Say, it's not that big a challenge. Let me tell you how to fix it. And the dean doesn't have to do it all. We've got good people who know their shit. All right. Ken Schneck, thank you for being here. I really appreciate you. And you're always welcome back.
Thank you so much.
Promised you we were going to go all over the place. But I do think it was okay because it's what's needed. I think as we consider the challenges that will be navigated for literally decades to come because of these laws and these pieces and these acts of legislation, we need to keep in mind and heed Ken's advice and his love of SIP systems. And we need to be sure that whatever we decide to do, we consider three steps down the road. And if whatever we put into place, will those policies achieve intended outcomes? Thank you for being an Office Hours listener. In order to grow our community, please rate, review, and share the podcast with your network. I would very much appreciate it. And hey, don't forget the show notes. There you'll find more information on Ken, the Buckeye Flame, a link to his article from years past in the Huffington Post. And of course, you'll also find information on how to follow me on social media and become a subscriber to my newsletter. Thank you to my wonderful producer, David Yaz. Office Hours is a production of the Pod 617 Studios in beautiful Westwood, Massachusetts. Now get on out there and learn something.